Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to The Traveling Eye on HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm your host, Javon Harley. Head on over to our website. It's thetravelingeye.com. There you can friend and like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can also join the Travel Club, and we want you to do that. Today I have a great show for you. It's very special to me. It's very near and dear to me, and that is in honor of Black History Month. We're going to trace some of those historic landmarks that pay homage to African Americans. Also, later on, we've got Javon's Travel Minute. And have you ever wondered why they dim the lights or ask you to raise the shade upon takeoff and landing? I'm going to answer that question for you, too. But first, I've got some travel news. Starting with JetBlue. A few years ago, when New York residents were recovering from Hurricane Sandy, many people in the area were stranded without food, electricity, and resources. Businesses were shut down, and public transportation was too. JetBlue Airlines, best known for its New York air service, was also grounded. JetBlue's manager of corporate social responsibility, Kate Wetzel, said that they realized the hometown was in need. A crew member who had only just finished her internship with JetBlue lived in one of the areas that was hardest hit by the hurricane and realized people were not only cold, but they were also hungry. She said, "All I want right now is food, and I think there are a lot of people in the neighborhood who would love it if there were more food." So JetBlue then contacted the New York Food Truck Association and arranged for a fleet of food trucks to visit the region's hardest hit communities. They took portable charging stations out to neighborhoods that had been flooded and where people were unable to get out to work or even call. Then a pay it forward movement happened. Other companies wanted to sponsor food trucks. Local companies that heard about JetBlue's efforts stepped up, and then the Food Truck Association itself donated money back. One person had an idea that everyone rallied behind. It became something that people wanted to participate in. Wetzel noted that while the company received a significant boost in brand recognition, it also realized the power that comes from passionate, engaged staff. It connects employees with their community's needs, and it connects them more passionately with the jobs they are hired to do. They learned that crew members who volunteer have better on-time departure rates, better baggage claiming rates, and better customer service responses. And the airport stations, whose crew members work, are more engaged too. One of the primary reasons that JetBlue's skilled volunteering strategies works is the way it looks at brand in relationship to philanthropy. JetBlue made philanthropy a part of its company strategy. They involve their staff in concept and planning, and they make sure employees or crew members are part of that decision making. My hat's off and kudos to JetBlue. Which airlines get into Havana? Well, the feds will decide that. It's been more than 50 years since commercial flights from the U.S. could legally land in Cuba. And on the heels of the recent announcement allowing 110 daily flights to the island, domestic airlines now have just under 2 weeks to explain to federal regulators why they deserve to operate some of those flights. The battle, however, is for Havana, because the agreement to restore commercial flights includes only 20 slots to the capital. Currently, there are only two airlines who have publicly proposed schedules, American Airlines and Delta Airlines. American Airlines, of course, from its hub in Miami. Delta Airlines wants to fly to Havana, but they have not specified any U.S. departure cities. JetBlue Airways is likely to request a flight from Fort Lauderdale and possibly one from Tampa or New York. United Airlines might seek to fly from its hub of Houston, Chicago, and Newark. This process of gaining authority to fly from the U.S. to the 10 international airports in Cuba will culminate with federal officials giving access based on an effort to maximize public benefits. The return of commercial flights between the U.S. and Cuba, which could occur as soon as this summer, will remain restricted to one of 12 permitted activities, and general tourism is not one of them. To win a route, the carriers cannot press the public interest in Cuba beach vacations. The U.S. allows travel to Cuba for things like professional meetings, athletic competitions, religious activities, and humanitarian projects. There are 12 categories that you have to be a part of. At least six major U.S. airlines have said they want to serve Cuba. the airlines must submit a detailed list of instructions with their proposals, including flight numbers, aircraft, cargo capacity, what type of charter service they currently serve, and a ranking of which cities that are most important to them. Regulators are likely to weigh the size of the city's Cuban-American population along with which routes are most conducive to business travel and other commercial engagement. After airlines submit their proposals, businesses and other parties will comment. One that will be active is Engage Cuba, a nonprofit group that lobbies to end the U.S. trade embargo and travel restrictions to Cuba. The group has 30 companies and trade associations like Choice Hotels International, Comcast Corp, Delta, and Honeywell International. They want airlines to choose routes that are commercially viable. Engage Cuba's president said, "We don't want them to open up an airline route and then shut it down 2 months later." He also considers a flight from Delta's largest hub in Atlanta critical because Georgia is the largest U.S. agricultural exporter to Cuba. Applications for commercial flights to Cuba are due by March 2nd, with public comments and airlines' responses continuing until March 21st. I can't believe that. Flights as soon as summer? Amazing. Well, we may soon be going to Cuba, but let's see about those restrictions. Southwest Airlines passengers, who are also Amazon.com shoppers, won't have to dig around for their wallet to pay for a movie on airplanes equipped with Wi-Fi. You can use Amazon Pay Wi-Fi access and other onboard entertainment. It's not the first time passengers will encounter pay with Amazon in flight. GoGo, a company that provides connectivity and entertainment services to Alaska Airlines and other carriers, also offer the Amazon option. Dubai's newest attraction is almost complete. The Dubai Frame Project is being constructed at Zabil Park by Dubai Municipality is 77% complete. The Frame, which is located near Stargate in Zabil Park, consists of two towers. Each tower is 492 feet tall and are 305 feet wide. They connect by a 320-square-foot bridge with room for visitors to take snapshots of the city's panorama. The tower's height is compared to that of a 50-story building. At the top, visitors will have a bird's-eye view of the old Dubai on one side, and as they turn around, they'll see the high-rise towers and development projects of new Dubai. And once open, the museum will be located on the ground floor. It'll showcase artifacts representing new and old Dubai and will be equipped with multimedia presentations narrating the progress of Dubai's rapid transformation from a small fishing and trading town by the sea to a modern metropolis. Another attraction that I can talk about today is at Universal. They have revealed details about a new blockbuster attraction. The Universal Resorts Islands of Adventure Skull Island, Reign of King Kong, will bring the next generation of the King Kong legend to life. It will be an exotic world, a powerful storyline, a 3D experience, innovative technology, and, of course, the unexpected. It'll be one of the Universal Orlando's most massive adventures yet. It'll be a multi-dimensional experience filled with surprise, the longest Universal ride experiences ever created. You set out to explore on an island rife with prehistoric creatures of unknown origin and the legend of a beast still undiscovered. You find yourself at a campus site at the Eighth Wonder Expedition Company, the research team leading your adventure. Once beyond the camp, you'll see signs of a native presence beating drums that draw you toward an ancient temple. A lost shrine is revealed, and proof that you're not alone. You board a specifically designed expedition vehicle, and that'll take you deeper into the island. Mysterious sounds pierce the air, and you hear chanting. And then you confront an enormous temple wall, complete with carvings and images. The temple's massive wooden doors slowly open to a labyrinth of caves. Inside the caves, you meet your expedition leader, and suddenly you find yourself in the midst of a raging struggle between creatures of incomprehensible size and ferocity. Then, as those creatures turn on you, there's an even more enormous earth-pounding presence. Bigger, closer, and more overwhelming than you can imagine. it's Kong. But is he a friend or a foe? Well, you'll have to find out when the Universal Orlando Resort's Island of Adventure Skull Island opens up. I know that was dramatic, but I had to do it. Okay, airlines may soon have a seat for the obese. Airbus, one of the top aircraft manufacturers, has designed a bench geared to fit two overweight passengers. Now, this is according to a patent application with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. They've designed a bench seat with customizable format. It allows for seat belts to be attached at different points to fit either larger or smaller passengers. And it's not only geared toward obese passengers. The seat can be configured to seat people with mobility problems or families with small children. Whether or not the bench makes its way onto airplanes, the idea certainly does have merit. Now, according to Airbus, two heavier passengers could sit side by side with the seat belts adjusted to fit them. The bench could also be reconfigured to fit a family of two adults and two smaller children, or three adults. The U.S. patent application notes the cabin layout should be flexibly, rapidly, and easily reconfigurable. Now, pricing would be up to the airline, and it's possible that the bench would allow airlines to charge passengers more. You just know they're going to do that. Since the bench can fit three adults or a family of four, one could only imagine that an airline might consider the bench as seating for three or four people and then charge passengers accordingly. Well, let's see if the bench will make it to market and what the airlines would charge for it. TSA is in trouble again. The world's busiest airport just told the TSA to shape up or be replaced by private security. That's Atlanta's Hartsfield Jackson International Airport. They issued a warning to the U.S. Transportation Safety Administration to get its act together or be replaced. Now, according to a letter from Hartsfield Jackson, General Manager Miguel Southwell to TSA Administrator Peter Neffinger, the airport's security screening checkpoints are understaffed with no sign of significant improvement in sight. In the letter, Southwell says the chronic staffing shortages are leading passengers to wait over half an hour at TSA checkpoints. If things don't change, the airport will bring in private security personnel under the TSA screening partnership program. Now, according to Southwell's letter, the TSA's Atlanta team did manage to get out a 7.5% staffing increase last year, but that proved to be late and inadequate. This is because the airport, which had more than 96 million passengers in 2014, saw traffic increase 10% over the same period last year. So that means an increase of 10%, but only an increase of 7.5% for staffing. Mike England, a spokesman for the TSA, wrote in an email to Business Insider, "We recognize that the issues raised in the letter are a concern, not just in Atlanta, which is fueled primarily by the rapid growth in travel volume, combined with a renewed focus on their security mission." He states that while they're working on better solutions, they believe the public will support their vital mission while ensuring safe transportation. Well, that's it for travel news. Make sure you stay tuned because up next is Javon's Travel Minute and those national historic landmarks that are paying homage to African Americans. You're listening to The Traveling Eye. I'm Javon Harley on HUR Voices Sirius XM Channel 141. Welcome back to The Traveling Eye on HUR Voices Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Javon Harley. Make sure you check out our website. It's thetravelingeye.com. There you can friend and like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And we want you to join the Travel Club.
And now, Javon's Travel Minute.
Long flights can be grueling, but there are ways you can make it less brutal. Make yourself as comfortable as possible. Dress in stretch fabrics and thin layers, or bring a light jogging suit to change into. Bring a neck pillow. I like the ones with microbeads. They're much softer. Come out of your shoes and put on travel socks, the ones with a sole to protect your feet against germs. Stay hydrated, internally and externally. Drink plenty of water, starting days before your trip and during the flight. And don't forget about your skin. Moisturize with a night cream and bring along a hydrating facial spray and chapstick. Earplugs, earbuds, or noise-canceling headphones will keep out unwanted noise that may otherwise annoy you or keep you awake. This is Javon, and that was your Travel Minute. I am proud. Proud to be black. Proud to be an African American woman. I'm proud of my parents. I'm proud of my grandparents and all of those who came before me. That's why today I'm making virtual stops at some national historic landmarks that pay homage to African American heroes and sheroes. These incredible individuals made major contributions in America while facing tremendous strife and tragedy. Through it all, they persevered and gave of themselves selflessly. My first stop is in Tuskegee, Alabama, at Tuskegee Institute. This university was part of the expansion of education for blacks in the South following the Civil War. A historical black college, it first opened in 1881 as Talladega College, with a student body of 30 and one teacher, Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington arrived in Alabama and started building the Tuskegee Institute. He recruited the best and the brightest to come and teach, including George Washington Carver, who arrived in 1896. Carver's innovations in agriculture, especially peanuts, expanded Tuskegee's standing throughout the country. The George Washington Carver Museum is part of this historic site. It was originally constructed in 1915 as the campus laundry. In 1941, it was dedicated as the museum. There's also the Oaks, which was the family home of Booker T. Washington. The house was built in 1899 by students and faculty using bricks made by students. Tuskegee also had a well-respected aeronautical engineering program. Because of this, the United States military selected Tuskegee Institute as a place to train African-American pilots for the war effort. Their rigorous training molded over 1,000 pilots into one of the most highly respected U.S. fighter groups of World War II. These pilots are known as the Tuskegee Airmen. As part of the National Park Service, you can get information for visiting Tuskegee Institute at nps.gov. Heading north, we discover the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway in Dorchester and Caroline Counties on Maryland's eastern shore. This site preserves and recounts the life story of Harriet Tubman and her courageous acts. She's one of the most lauded figures in American history. Born into slavery in Maryland around 1822, Tubman successfully escaped to Philadelphia in 1849. Once free, she became an operator of the Underground Railroad, a secret network of people, places, and routes that provided shelter and assistance for escaping slaves. She boldly returned south at least 13 times to rescue family and friends, guiding them safely to freedom. By 1860, Tubman had earned the nickname Moses for selflessly liberating the enslaved. In 2013, President Obama proclaimed this site a national monument. Its landscape is deeply associated with Tubman and the Underground Railroad. It includes the Jacobs Jackson home site, one of the first houses along the Underground Railroad, Bethel Church, where African Americans worshipped at that time, Stewart's Canal, which provided an escape route for slaves, and the James Cook home site, where Tubman herself was hired out as a child. With more than 30 sites along a 125-mile scenic road, including the newly designated Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Historical Park, a self-guided driving tour shows you the places where Tubman grew up, worshipped, labored, and led others to freedom. For information and to map your own course of the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, visit HarrietTubmanByway.org.
I'm in charge of the underground railroad.
In Great Barrington, Massachusetts, is the W.E.B. Du Bois National Historic Site. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the most influential, provocative, and literary voices in the 20th century. He was an American historian, civil rights activist, and author. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois' story begins on his birthday, February 23, 1868, in the small rural town of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The life and values of rural New England and its small African-American community, some of whose members fought in the famous all-black 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry Regiment, shaped Du Bois' early years and his ideas about democracy, education, and family. In 1885, Du Bois left home for Fisk University, studied in Berlin, and became the first African-American to graduate with a Ph.D. from Harvard University in 1895. By age 35, Du Bois had published The Suppression of the African Slave Trade, The Philadelphia Negro, and The Souls of Black Folk, his seminal work. He was a founder and leader of the Niagara Movement, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the Pan-African Congresses. Du Bois served as the editor of the Crisis magazine for 24 years and lectured throughout the world well into his later life. His prominence and ideas were threatening to some, and in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, he was falsely accused of being an agent of a foreign power and later exonerated of all charges. At the invitation of the president of Ghana, Du Bois moved to Ghana at the age of 93 to undertake writing the Encyclopedia Africana. A self-guided interpretive trail highlights Du Bois' journey from Great Barrington to the world stage and presents information from ongoing archaeological excavations, as well as the home site dedication in 1969. There's also the W.E.B. Du Bois in Great Barrington walking and motor tour that takes you to 17 sites revealing the towns, people, and places that were important to Du Bois. You can download the guide at DuBoisNHS.org. Now, why don't we head west to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas? There we find the Buffalo Soldier Memorial Park. In 1866, the U.S. Congress authorized the formation of several black regiments known as the United States Colored Troops, composed of black soldiers led by white officers. This reorganization formed two regiments of black cavalry and four regiments of black infantry. These men were the first black soldiers to serve during peacetime. These unsung heroes were fathers, sons, brothers, and husbands. They were former slaves, Civil War veterans, and brave patriots. Just as their white colleagues, these men came from all walks of life. But the biggest question about the Buffalo Soldiers is why the name? Some say it's because of the heavy buffalo robes the soldiers wore on winter campaigns. Others say that when the American bison was wounded or cornered, it fought ferociously, displaying uncommon stamina and courage, identical to the black man in battle. Whatever the reason for the name, the buffalo soldier, armed with a .45-70 caliber rifle, a Colt .45 caliber pistol, and